But it also helps that he's a billionaire and he's a hard body 27-year-old or something.
and he's a sex maniac, you know?
And he's a sex maniac.
Yeah. He happens to be into S&M, so I'm not sure why that's such a big turnout.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. It's the Two Boomer Babes.
Coming up, a renowned doctor claims patients are receiving care in some of the best hospitals that's unnecessary, outdated, or downright dangerous.
A behind-the-scenes glimpse at hotel life, how to get that killer upgrade.
And eat out of the mini bar for free.
Want to uncover your desire and heal a sexless marriage? Stay tuned.
And Playing the Bells, how a couple of ringers charm Memphis, Tennessee.
If we must go to a hospital, we hope it's to get better. But in fact, we could be putting our lives at risk. According to the New England Journal of Medicine, 1 in 4 hospital patients are harmed in some way by a medical mistake. To put it in perspective, if medical errors were a disease, they would be the 6th cause of death in America. And every day, even in our most prestigious hospitals, people are receiving care that may be unnecessary, outdated, or downright dangerous. Pretty scary stuff.
Dr. Marty McCary is a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and he says it doesn't have to be this way. He developed a surgical checklist adopted by the World Health Organization. Dr. McCary is the author of Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. He joins us on the phone from Baltimore. Great to have you on the show, doctor.
Good to be with you.
Why all these medical errors? Is this something new? What's going on?
Well, for the first time, we're being honest about the problem. Look, doctors are human. I'm a human being, and I've made mistakes. Some are preventable, and others are not. We need to look to see how we can re-engineer our system so that our system is safer. You know, you have more information in going to a restaurant than you do in choosing a hospital. 60% of New Yorkers will look up an online rating before they choose a restaurant. And we're hearing the frustration again and again from patients. I feel like I'm walking in blind, and it doesn't need to be that way.
You talk about a lot of things that contribute to these errors, and one of them is this culture of silence that allows these errors to go unchecked and unreported, and bad doctors continue to practice. So how is that even possible?
Well, we don't have good ways of sort of monitoring quality in healthcare, or at least we haven't until very recently when doctors' groups have put together databases and registries to monitor how well patients and hospitals perform. That information needs to be available to the public, and we're starting to see a revolution in medicine to make our outcomes and our performance more public, more transparent. But, you know, we've got 46% of doctors burned out in the United States, according to a big national study from the Mayo Clinic a few months ago. Doctors are getting crushed right now. They're being told they need to see more patients, do more procedures, not refer to certain places. Their malpractice premiums are going up. Their Medicare payments are going down, overhead's going up. I mean, doctors are getting crushed right now, and certainly that's a factor.
Doctor, you write about your first day at Harvard. We love this little vignette that when you were in medical school and residents kept referring to one doctor as Dr. Hodad, what did they mean?
Well, at a bunch of hospitals I've rotated through, there seems to be one doctor that everybody knows is dangerous, that probably shouldn't be practicing. And one of the terms used to describe this particular individual was HODAD. It stands for Hands of Death and Destruction. And the residents, and when we were students, we'd joke around almost, and we'd refer to this patient as a patient of HODADs. But it really struck me later on that we sort of socialize our young trainees and students, as I was being socialized, to think differently about safety. We almost accepted it. We almost learned the rules subconsciously. We were almost modeled the behavior that you look away when something isn't right. And I think that's part of the problem. It's the culture in which we practice that needs to change, and it is changing.
Why are doctors so afraid to call out other doctors? I mean, is this a code of silence?
Certainly, it's difficult. There are local political implications. I mean, let's face it, when I was a student and I saw Dr. Hodad and I saw what everyone else saw, I'm being evaluated. Residents are being evaluated. Trainees are being evaluated. Even as a practicing physician, let's face it, medicine is a referral business. And we sort of learn the rules early that you don't question or raise a flag about other practices that look unsafe because one, you may not know the whole story, and two, there are ramifications if you do. And we need good external peer review. We need good ways to monitor quality. And in Unaccountable, we try to get at these new metrics of performance that are starting to monitor quality in healthcare in ways that the public can look them up and see how well people are doing.
And Dr. McCary, are hospitals starting to implement these statistics?
Yes, we've got a number of U.S. hospitals that have stepped up to the plate and said, we believe transparency in our hospital performance is a public right. Many people are saying, does the public have a right to know about the quality of their hospitals? And a lot of these hospitals and doctors groups are saying, yes, people deserve to know the information that's being collected, especially when it's taxpayer funded. We've got over 150 national registries in healthcare, databases that are independent that monitor how well patients perform at certain hospitals. About a quarter of these are taxpayer funded, yet only 1% of the national registries make their data available to the public. So we're starting to see some glimmers of transparency, but right now it's being driven mostly by the doctors and hospitals that are saying this is the right thing to do.
Now, do you think some either states or this will be a federal law that they have to post their statistics on like infection rates and complications, surgical complications, et cetera? Do you see that happening down the line?
Absolutely, and it is happening. It's happening right now in Congress and among the doctors' groups. A lot of them are driving it. But to be honest, you know, I was one of the doctors that opposed for many years the release of hospital performance of our complication rates. And, you know, the reason was, for a long time, the raw data was not very valid. It just wasn't statistically meaningful. In fact, it punished the doctors that took on the high-risk cases and rewarded those that avoided them. It created perverse incentives. But now the metrics, the ways we measure quality, have matured. The doctors have authored them and endorsed them, and the doctors' groups are monitoring outcomes. Those are the metrics we need to be looking at as a society.
Dr. McCary, what can hospital patients do to be more informed in choosing a hospital or agreeing to a procedure?
Well, in the book Unaccountable, we try to go through some of the new websites that guide patients in navigating the healthcare system. Some of these sites, for example, are the Consumer Reports website, consumerreportshealth.org. ZocDoc has good patient satisfaction information, which is one small piece of the quality maze. Hospitalcompare.hhs.gov is a great site. There are a lot of sites like that out there, and we've put a lot of questions up that patients should ask of their hospitals and doctors on the website unaccountablebook.com. You know, there's simple patient checklists that patients can have that empower them to ask questions like, what if I don't have this procedure done? Or is there a minimally invasive option?
We are speaking with Dr. Marty McCary, a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Our topic, dysfunction in hospital care and how transparency can revolutionize the healthcare system. His book is called Unaccountable. Dr. McCary, we were just talking about procedures and potentially unnecessary procedures, et cetera. But how, as a patient, do we know if the test is really necessary? I mean, we just have to go, as you say, do lots of research. What do we do? How do we know?
Well, you know, I've got some patients that come to my practice and they say, Doc, whatever you want to do, I totally trust you. And I've got other patients that come in and they've researched on the internet what they're going to have done. They've asked many questions and they're highly informed. In today's medical culture, you want to be highly informed. You want to trust your doctor, yet you want to research what's out there. One quarter of all second opinions are different from the first opinion. There's a lot of variation in what we do. According to the Institute of Medicine, 30% of all healthcare expenditures are unnecessary. We're talking about medications, tests, procedures, unnecessary. So it's important for patients to do that research and ask the question.
And this is really costly.
Absolutely. I mean, it's bankrupting our country. You talk to anybody paying their health insurance premiums, they're going up every year. The deductibles are going up so high, they're crushing families and businesses that are trying to compete with businesses overseas. I mean, it is the number one driver of the growth of our national debt, and we've got to get serious about healthcare spending. And how can we get serious about healthcare spending if we don't talk about the 30% of healthcare expenditures that are unnecessary, according to the Institute of Medicine?
But Dr. McCary, I have to tell you, when I'm researching some procedures that have been recommended to me, I go on WebMD or some of these other sites, and it drives me crazy. Because how do you know that what you're looking at is really good information for the consumer?
it is easy to get totally overwhelmed and even unnecessarily frightened by what's out there on the internet. But there are some great websites that I think people research, print out a couple pages, and bring it in with their doctor and talk to them and say, you know, I've been reading some concerning things about statins, or do I need this hysterectomy done through an open incision? I read that it can be done laparoscopically. And I find that a lot of patients that do some research can really help navigate their own care to make it better and safer.
And doctor, we have to ask you about how some doctors are also rewarded for doing something as well. Is it true that some receive kickbacks from drug companies and device manufacturers and are actually paid bonuses by hospitals for procedures?
It's shocking, isn't it, that in 2013, doctors are paid direct kickbacks from the industry and don't have to disclose them to their patients. Now, we've come a long way in disclosure, and a lot of people say, look, we've got transparency now. You disclose these conflicts of interest to the hospital and to the doctors' groups. But, you know, my issue is we're disclosing these conflicts to everybody except for the poor person who needs to know about them, the patient. So these conflicts of interest need to be more transparent. Patients should ask about them, and they should know there is this giant rivalry right now in American medicine. Do we pay doctors based on the volume of what they do, or do we pay them based on the quality of what they do?
Well, Kathy and I were just talking, and maybe it's our age, but is it any coincidence like every other person we know is having some sort of replacement in their body? You know, we hope there aren't a lot of kickbacks involved in that one, but...
Is it a hint when you're given a whole package of something for free at the doctor's office that that manufacturer might be supporting the doctor?
Well, by and large, those things have been rolled back significantly. The industry has been under a lot of scrutiny, especially with their clinical trials information where they don't report findings that aren't in their favor. That's changing. But, you know, I should say doctors are good people. They are trying to do their best. Oftentimes we've got a lot of good people working in a bad system. And I think we've got tremendously brilliant and creative doctors out there to do the best for their patients, but they've got all these perverse incentives and things that they don't like and that they're now speaking up about.
Dr. McCary, we have to ask you real quickly, only a few seconds left, but how have your colleagues reacted to this book? I mean, do you still have people to eat lunch with at the cafeteria, we hope?
Well, by and large, the response has been tremendously positive from this book, despite the title that the publisher put on the book. But there is a small old guard of medicine that says we shouldn't be talking about over-treatment and medical mistakes with the public. It's rare. It doesn't occur. Of course, many doctors' groups in the last few months, even the months before the book's release, have come out and said, we've got a major national crisis with over-treatment, over-diagnosis, and unnecessary tests.
Dr. Marty McCary, author of Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare, thanks so much for chatting with the Two Boomer Babes.
Up next, what really goes on behind the scene at hotels? Stay with us and find out.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
For more than a decade, Jacob Tomsky has been on the front lines of the hotel industry. Starting fresh out of college with a degree in philosophy, he found work as a hotel valet parker. Rising fast through the ranks in an upscale Manhattan hotel, he held virtually every job imaginable, from manning the front desk to supervising the housekeeping department. Let's just say, when it comes to hotels, he has seen and done it all.
In his new book, Heads in Beds, a reckless memoir of hotels, hustles, and so-called hospitality, Jacob Tomsky takes us behind the scenes of hotel life. He offers inside tips on everything from how to eat out of the minibar for free to getting that killer upgrade. Jacob joins us on the phone from New York City. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are really excited about you giving us the inside scoop for getting a fabulous hotel experience. So first up, the room. I mean, we've seen those reports on the news about those filthy rooms, even in upscale hotels. So as a former housekeeping manager, what's the number one thing guests should not touch?
I would go straight to the minibar glass for that. You do not want to touch that. During my time as a housekeeping manager, I noticed that the housekeepers clean that glass with what they have available. And if you look on the housekeeper's cart, they don't have dish soap. What they do have is shampoo as well as furniture polish. So I've seen them, you know, put the hot water in the sink, put it in there with some shampoo, and to really get that streak-free glass, just wipe it down with a rag that has some furniture polish on it. So you definitely want to rinse that out, if not avoid it altogether.
Jacob, I'm kind of surprised you didn't say the comforter.
A lot has happened on that comforter is the answer to that question. If it's a duvet cover and you've got the duvet inside and then they've got the cover on the outside, you can pretty much trust that. But if it's something that looks like it goes on top of the bed completely, it's probably not washed all that often. If there's any kind of extra blankets in the closet, you want to avoid those because they're not in the rotation as often. So yeah, anything that looks like it's not a sheet, you definitely don't really want to cuddle up with that.
So what should we do? Bring our own?
No, you can ask for extra sheets, or that's why most hotels do have the comforters, you know, like with the duvet cover, which is the safest way to do it. But, you know, you just roll it back a little bit and keep your lower half warm.
Okay, now should we assume that the toilet has been cleaned?
For that, I would say yes. I mean, I don't know how many people clean their bathroom every day. Probably no one. You know, I cleaned rooms while I was a manager, and it is a very difficult job. And obviously, that's step one in hotels. So they do work very hard to make sure that bathroom is sparkling.
Okay, so let's get on to the free stuff. You give tips for getting a room upgrade. And of course, we want to pay for the basic room, but we really want that corner suite with a balcony and a fabulous view. So how do we do that?
And breakfast.
Well,
and free minibar.
It all comes to the front desk. And I think, you know, one of my missions in Heads in Beds was to sort of explain what the front desk does because, you know, people complain. It's like, oh, they're just typing. They're not doing anything. That's absolutely not true. We are choosing what room you get. And the rooms are incredibly varied. So a gratuity at check-in, tipping the front desk agent, is a way to sort of, you know, make us make that decision for you because we have to upgrade. And we know. We're familiar with every single room. You might not know. I can look you in the face and be like, you know, this is a great room. But you don't know that. But I actually do. So kindness, to begin with, a little bit of kindness instead of, you know, requesting instead of demanding is a good start. But even just a little gratuity at check-in, I guarantee you, since it's not a tips position, the front desk agent's going to do what they can to find the best room for you.
But Jacob, let me ask you about that tipping or kindness, as you call it. How do you do that without making it look like a bribe? I mean, do you wrap a bill around your credit card? How do you do that?
You can do that, but I mean, we deal with cash all the time. So, you know, if you're handing me money, it looks like I'm getting change. And, you know, I don't think it's a drug deal. I don't think it's anything shady. It's a very kind thing to do. You know, basically, you know, it's a hard job. You're on your feet all day dealing with guest complaints. And, you know, when I get tipped, I you know, I'm like, okay, well, here's $10, let's say. You know, maybe I can get a nicer meal for lunch than I was going to get, or maybe I can go meet my friends when I didn't, you know, it's rent due and I didn't quite have enough money. I mean, these are just little things that make me feel good. And I'm like, oh, okay, my life has improved slightly, you know, and you really don't have to be secretive about it. It's a nice thing to do. And if you've ever seen anyone else tip, they look great doing it. You've never been like, oh my God, that guy just gave him money. It's like, that looks really good, you know?
Okay, but tell us about the mini bar. How do we get free stuff out of there?
Okay, well, this is a little bit morally loose, so you got to be wary of that. I'm not necessarily advocating stealing. I just wanted to make sure that I explained every part of this process. Again, as a front desk agent, I spent all morning removing charges from the bill, and the most disputed charge is the minibar charge. That's because the system is incredibly fallible, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong to mischarge it. Hence, if you do ransack the minibar and you wake up and you're like, oh, no, you know, a little bit of disputing will get all of that gone because, you know, a hotelier does not want to accuse you of lying. They don't want to go through your garbage. They're mostly after the room rate. Those markups are huge, so they're just going to take it off.
But Jacob, That's stealing, and you'd have to then go to confession. You can't
and
do
then
that.
And what are we teaching our children? Because they're the ones that are going to ransack the minibar, probably.
Call the cops, you guys. There's thievery out there. I've seen it happen. I'm not suggesting it necessarily. I'm just saying this is one of the things I've learned. I know people do this, and you know it's done pretty often.
But then don't they wonder like who's eaten this? I mean, it's obvious somebody's taken it or eaten it.
Not necessarily, because especially now that everything's that everything's electronic. I mean, some people just put a sandwich on top to keep it cold, and they get like 15, 16 charges. So you really don't know what's really in the room and out of the room. And if it's not an electronic minibar, then maybe the person before you ate it and they forgot to stock it. Maybe they skipped that room. Maybe they didn't see it. It's just that system is unbelievably hard to be accurate. I would say it's impossible. So there's really no way they can tell what you've had and what you haven't had.
Okay, good to know. When we come back, more with Jacob Tomsky, author of Heads in Bed. Stay with us.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is Kathy and Barb, the two Boomer Babes. We're continuing our conversation with Jacob Tomsky, author of Heads in Beds. Jacob, tell us, what are the most annoying words guests can say to a front desk clerk?
One of my least favorite phrases was, I'm your most frequent guest. I've had that one thrown at me 1,000 times. I stay here all the time. I must be one of your top guests. And this is someone who's stayed there maybe 5-6 times in the year. And we've got guests that stay, 5 days a week. So that's really, asserting how important you are. I've been here before, or asking for an upgrade, as in, like, they told me I should ask for an upgrade, or name dropping, like, I know the general manager. These are all things that, it's all about kindness. And when you start demanding and acting like you deserve something beyond what the other 250 checking in guests deserve, oftentimes you're not going to get it.
So let's continue this with a difficult guest. Now, we know hotel staff have to keep a stiff upper lip and grin and bear it around a really difficult guest, but you say it's a whole different story when they're out of sight. So what are the ways hotel employees seek revenge on a guest?
That was one of the most interesting things about a hotel. We have so much control. We can start with the room that I can look a guest in the face and say, you know what? This is a beautiful room. They were rude. They said something inappropriate. And I'm like, you know what? This is a beautiful room. And it's not a beautiful room. I did in New York, I would put people in 1212. 1212 is a very nice room, but it's also the area code is 212. And people don't know to dial out in hotels. Some people still don't know to dial 9 or whatever you have to dial. So if I put you in 1212 all day, people are going to pick up their phones, and all night people are going to pick up their phones and start dialing the local area code 1212, and 1212 is going to phone rings off the hook. So there's many, many ways. I can mess with your keys.
That is very nasty. We're shocked.
I did it to only people that deserved it. People who made like racist or sexist or homophobic comments, or they were yelling and screaming. And there's definitely that was one of the parts of the job is sort of instant karma, because really not everyone can get a good room. So we have to decide which guests deserve a good room. And trust me, I never did it for any reason that wasn't very valid. I got very good at determining who deserved what, and all the kind guests and all the polite people and the good travelers out there, they all got taken care of when they came to me.
Bottom line is, it just be kind and polite, and that's probably going to do you the most good in terms of getting freebies and getting a great room.
Yeah, that's a very good start. That was one of my missions with Heads in Beds, is to sort of humanize what we do, because I don't think people really sit down and think about what the bellman's job is and how hard the housekeeper's life is and what we do at the front desk. So just to really understand what we're doing, what we can do for you, what we can't do for you, and just to come at us with a little bit of respect and a little bit of knowledge, that actually, it helps us help you.
Jacob, what's up with booking through those internet discount sites like Priceline? Does that guarantee us a worst room in the house? Because I have to tell you, whenever I book through those sites, I get rooms that smell like dog or, you know, they're right by the elevator.
Yeah, you know, it kind of does, because when you think about it from a business perspective here, those come in bulk. So obviously you chose the hotel based on price, which is a totally fine way to shop, but then you're put up against 50 other reservations for people who booked through the property, and they're paying $100, $200, $300 more than you, and they chose this property, which means they'll probably choose it again. So you're in a position there where you don't look like you're ever going to come back again, and you're paying a lesser rate. So because of that, you're going to be, you know, taken a little bit less care of, because you know, it doesn't seem to apply to any future stay. But there's ways to get around that. The important thing is, because when you're booking online, that's a third-party system. They don't know what the room features are. You know, they've never been to this hotel, and they never will be to this hotel. They never will visit this hotel. So best thing to do is, after you book online, give the hotel a call. Call the front desk, the hotel proper, not the reservations line, and find out. Speak to a human being, because at that point, you're no longer part of this discount masses. You're a human being, and I'm talking to you, and I'm confirming what you have, and now I'm going to take care of you, because you no longer just came in with this bulk deluge.
I love this advice. Jacob Tomsky, author of Heads and Beds, a reckless memoir of hotels, hustles, and so-called hospitality. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
It was a pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.
Up next, for those of us underwhelmed by sex and overwhelmed with life, a sex therapist has some answers. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
The images are all around us. Just go to the movies, turn on the TV, or flip through a magazine, and it seems like everyone is having wild, mind-blowing sex all the time, except for about 40 million American women. With the demands of work, kids, sometimes adult kids, aging parents, and taking care of a house, we're lucky if we have the energy to put on our flannels before we collapse in a heap at the end of the day.
In response to the plight of millions of women and men, sex therapist Lori Watson has penned Wanting Sex Again, How to Discover Your Desire and Heal a Sexless Marriage. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You write that many people are overwhelmed by life and underwhelmed by sex, and I want you not to put me in that category.
But you can put me in that category, Lori.
Well, is this why maybe so many people would rather kind of zone out in front of the TV rather than have sex? And I can't imagine that, but tell us.
I think so. And I think that for women, because my book does focus on women with low libido, they really need to negotiate with their partner to get a fair shake in bed and out of bed so that they have help doing what they're, you know, getting the responsibilities taken care of, and so that their partner knows what pleases them in bed. Both places, they really have to feel like they represent themselves to reduce that sense of, I'm exhausted, I'm, you know, totally at the end here of my rope.
And help, you're referring to maybe some household help or people
household
pitching
help.
In if you can't afford?
Absolutely. I think if you can afford it, I think people at the career building and child rearing stage should hire out every piece of non-essential work. Hire somebody to come in and do the laundry and the house cleaning and the lawn and everything. And if you can't afford it, then you have to consider that that's another job. And that has to be divided fairly. Child care is one job. Housekeeping is another job. And producing financial sustenance for the family is a third job. And if both people are working, then those other two jobs have to be divided fairly. Not necessarily equally, but fairly.
Oh, I love what you're saying. And Lori, tell me, who are these 40 million women that you speak so vividly about in your book? Are they boomers? Who are they?
Yes, they're both. Actually, women and sexless marriages happen within 2 years. About 20% of all marriages are having sex less than 10 times a year. And another 15% are having sex less than 25 times a year. So those are newlyweds. That's not just menopausal women. Those are people who have just gotten married.
Wow,
that's a little scary.
Yeah, that's scary. Very scary.
Yeah, people who are partnered, committed partnership or married, basically are having sex, you know, less than you could possibly imagine for honeymooners.
Well, let's talk about what we could do to change that, Lori.
Good.
So, we don't need to tell you, and we certainly know, that men and women are very different animals when it comes to sex, and I think that women like to be romanced and seduced, and maybe men don't need that so much. So how do you change that? How do you get on the same planet, so to speak?
I like that. I think that that's true. I think that women need an enormous influx of connection and feelings of connection to their partner to maintain desire. Men are funded with sometimes 300 times the testosterone than women are. And testosterone is the hormone in both genders that governs desire, the craving for sex. You know, women will come to the bed willing to have sex, and they don't crave it until they're actually already aroused. So once they get going and they're in the middle of it, then they think, you know, I'm really glad I started this because I do want it. And that's natural and normal if they can give themselves. That's how women need to sometimes let it be okay for them. I'm going to start even though I don't have that craving for it, and I know that once I get there, I will. So if they can start that way sometimes with receptive desire, not necessarily the desire that would initiate or ask for sex, then people get more on a pattern of regular sex. And if men can remember that women really need to feel connected and do the things that help her, like call her during the middle of the day, set aside a time for a date time where they really, once a week, they talk with each other deeply. That helps. Or put the kids to bed at 9 o'clock and then make love after that instead of waiting till 11 when you're dead tired.
Or cook dinner and do the dishes.
Light
Nothing
the candles.
Sexier.
Woman porn, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Light the candles, jump in the jacuzzi. That's what I say.
Yeah.
What about the big M, menopause? You talked about, you know, low libido. What about hormone replacement therapies?
Okay, our libido does naturally fall because our ovaries shut down, and our ovaries manufacture at least 50% of our testosterone. So as we age, we have even less than we ever had. But I believe that women actually usually get to desire by fantasizing about it, thinking about it, and imagining it. So that just needs to continue. I think that hormone replacement, we absolutely know that being filled with estrogen and sometimes testosterone supplementation for the right candidate can help with a feeling of physiological desire. But it's not right for everybody. You know, sometimes we have risk factors that don't make it possible.
This is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes, and we are talking to sex therapist Lori Watson about her new book, Wanting Sex Again, How to Discover Your Desire and Heal a Sexless Marriage. Well, not that I'm speaking from experience here, but another thing that might put a damper on our sex life is that things might take a little bit longer, you know, both for men and women as we get a little bit older. And it can actually become rather time consuming and a big production. I mean, I could be asleep, you know, halfway into it. So how do we overcome this?
Actually, I think the big production is kind of part of the charm.
Right.
That's what makes Kathy and I so compatible.
And you know, women are tired during menopause because sometimes they have night sweats that wake them up and keep them up. So you're right about that. And you're absolutely right that our bodies are going to take longer. But the other truth is that men's bodies often take more stimulation and take longer, too. So we can be, I mean, a man at, you know, middle age may need Viagra, and that takes some time to work. So during that season when you're, those 30 minutes you're waiting for the Viagra to take hold, you know, then he can be stimulating her and making love to her in a way that her body is getting aroused. I really think we can be compatible in it. If you can relax and say, you know, it's not like it used to be, and that's not dysfunctional. That's not wrong. That's not bad. That doesn't mean I don't love my partner or that I don't like sex. My body is just going to take longer.
Lori, is it possible for people to kind of rekindle their sex lives once marriage has been sexless for a while?
Absolutely.
So how do you go about doing it?
How do we get our sexy back?
Okay. I think one major issue is that sometimes people have a power struggle, and the best place to play it out seems to be over sex. One person wants closeness, connection, and typically sex, and that's why they get into partnership, and the other person, you know, needs some respect and space and time, and those two needs are inversely connected. You know, we can't have closeness and space all at the same time, and so we play it out over the sex game. Think about a man who gets really preoccupied and excited about his career, and a woman who maybe is working too, but her children become her focus, and she's all about home and hearth, and he's all about the job and things like that. But he wants to be close in bed. That's how he gets close. And she wants nothing to do with that. See, they flip-flop over this place. The distance between them stays the same, and so they're not intimate. And this power struggle, I really believe, is the main cause of sexlessness.
Don't you also think that in a long-term relationship, there's some sort of boredom, like things become routine? Doesn't it also help to to have some element of surprise? Like if my husband's out there listening, make a reservation at the Inn at Little Washington. You know, surprise us.
Right. Women, too, need variety and creativity. I think sometimes I talk with women and they have spent more time, you know, necessarily working on their children's birthday party than on thinking about how to bring that creative, artistic part to the bedroom. And men, I think because they don't need that, they don't put enough forethought into the setting. They did when they were dating, right? The flowers and the dates and the planning that went into it, actually that still works for many women. I think women want to think, I'm on his mind. You know, that's a big turn-on, being interested in her world. They say after 40, the biggest turn-on is interest.
Lori, in your opinion, why has the 50 Shades of Grey become so popular with middle-aged women? Is that whole fantasizing kind of thing you're talking about?
Yes, I think it is a fantasy, and I think that the particular fantasy is not necessarily about a type of sex that they're having, but it's the intensity of the relationship between the man and the woman. I mean, Christian Grey, right, is obsessed. He's focused on her, and that's such a huge, exciting idea to have somebody's full attention when I think for many women, they say, you know what, he doesn't even put his phone down at dinner, and that's disappointing. But in the fantasy of 50 Shades of Grey, he's all about her.
But it also helps that he's a billionaire and he's hard body 27-year-old or something.
and he's a sex maniac, you know?
And he's a sex maniac.
He happens to be into S&M, so I'm not sure why that's such a big turn on.
Yeah.
But
yeah, actually, in reality, a very low percentage of people are into that, maybe like 2%.
Yeah. But do you think that's the popularity of this book is kind of representative that middle-aged women are kind of not satisfied in their sex life?
I do think so, and I think that's good news, that women want sex too. They may not want the sex that they're having because it's become too routine, like you said, but they do want an experience that is highly erotic.
Yeah, because everybody I know is reading this book, except for Kathy. But she did ask to borrow it, I have to say.
Well, I think diamonds and champagne, a little chocolate, you know, some fondue, whatever. I'm a pushover.
Yeah.
Or for me, it's taking out the garbage. You know, it's the simple things in life that I really like.
Right, and that's part of the problem with marriage, is we see each other in such mundane roles on a day-to-day basis.
Well, sex therapist Lori Watson, this has really been very enlightening. Thank you so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, Playing the Bells. A couple of ringers tell us how.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, aunt, son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment, and that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
We babes have learned to never underestimate the ingenuity and talent of boomers. Take, for example, Peggy McClure and David Caudle, who are carol annors for the Idlewild Presbyterian Church in Memphis, Tennessee. Yes, this lucky duo gets to play the bells.
The bell tower rises 120 feet above the main sanctuary of the church. It houses 50,000 pounds of steel, containing one of the South's heaviest and rarest musical instruments, a 20-ton carillon. Peggy and David join us on the phone to shoot the breeze from where else? Their bell tower. Great to have you with us.
We're glad to be here.
David, how does someone learn to play those ginormous bells? I mean, after all, we can't exactly put them in our living room to practice on.
Unfortunately, no. If you can read music, you can play the carillon.
Oh, Barbara, maybe we could do that.
I doubt it, Kevin.
Oh, yes, you can. It looks like a large version of an organ console with the white and black keys and the pedals. So if you can read music, you can play just about anything you want to on the bells.
Has anyone ever wondered what the heck a carillonneur is when you actually tell them that you're a carillonneur?
Yeah, that's right. They're like, what the heck is that? And they'll say, you know, I thought you were pronouncing it carillion or whatever. And I said, well, sometimes even though it's not published, I say, well, I'm the Hunchback of Notre Wild. But they do. People don't know what a carillonneur is.
So, Peggy, we're just trying to envision this. Help us out. Tell us about climbing the tower. How many steps are there?
There are about 52, and it's a very tight spiral staircase.
So it sounds like you can't have claustrophobia or height issues.
No.
Now, how often do you all play?
We play 3 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays, usually at noon. And if Peggy and I get together, we'll play duets in the afternoon, later afternoon.
And we have two concerts a year, sometimes right after church and sometimes late in the afternoon. And we play sometimes before special concerts or funerals, weddings, stuff like that.
Now, how far does this music travel? I mean, do people just stop in amazement on the streets and look up and listen to your beautiful music?
Some do, actually.
Really?
Yeah, they really do. And we had one lady that was leaving the grocery store right across the street from us, and she stuck her phone up in the air so she could let whoever was on the other end hear us play Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee.
The ultimate compliment.
Well, has anyone ever complained about the carillon?
Yes, there was this lady that lived in an apartment complex not far away that called and raised all kinds of cane because I was interrupting her favorite show, Judge Judy.
Oh, my
you
gosh.
You are kidding. So what's the best part about what you do?
Well, I think the fact that David and I, when people understand what a carillon is and we tell them the repertoire that we have, they're like going, and your church lets you play those songs? Because we pretty much play more secular music than we do religious music.
Baseball themes, football themes, anything that's going
Sax,
on. Elvis Presley.
And that makes it really fun because it really was intended to be a gift to the city. And so we don't presume that everybody wants to listen to religious Christian music. So we play a variety of things. And we get comments. One time I started up playing the University of Memphis fight song when we were in the basketball tournament. And before we even came down from the tower, a neighbor nearby who's a big Tiger fan had emailed the church and said, oh my gosh, this is so great. I just love y'all's church and what y'all do.
Well, Caroliners David Caudill and Peggy McClure, keep making beautiful music with those bells, and thanks so much for sharing your story with the Two Boomer Babes.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
The unusual careers of some boomer babes never cease to amaze us. Take, for example, Alexandra Mosca. She's been a funeral director, one of the very few women in the industry, for over 30 years. And during her tenure in the funeral biz, she was featured in and posed for, no, not Mortuary Today, but, of all things, Playboy magazine.
Alexandra joins us from New York City to shoot the breeze about a career in the mortuary biz and some of her favorite anecdotes that have happened along the way. Welcome, Alexandra.
Well, thank you for having me. Hello, Kathy. Hello, Barb. That was quite the introduction.
So glad you liked it.
Well, of course we have to start with this. I mean, your Playboy gig really piqued our interest. How on earth did that wild and crazy Hugh Hefner come a-calling?
At the time, there were very few women in the funeral industry, and I had been in the papers a number of times about what they considered unusual career at the time for a woman, and one of those clippings happened to make its way to Chicago to Playboy Enterprises. They were doing a series in the magazine of women who were in unusual professions, and so I got the call, which at first I thought was a joke.
Did they just see your headshot, or did they see more of your body, Alexandra?
No,
how did they know to call you?
They saw I had been a portrait model, and they saw some of my portraits and some of my photographs. I had done some modeling at that time.
Well, Alexandra, I'm just dying to know, did you actually meet Hugh? I mean, did you, like, hang out in the Playboy Mansion or anything?
I didn't meet you. I met Christy, though.
Twisty.
Oh, that's like five
daughter.
Girlfriends ago. Oh, that's the daughter.
Oh. Yes. She was running the show at the time, and I did get to meet her several times. She was very lovely. and I was out in Chicago. I did not make it to the Playboy Mansion in California.
So did you actually end up in the magazine? Did you pose nude?
I did, yes.
Wow.
But it's a strange thing today because with what goes on today in the media, Playboy seems sort of quaint now.
It's artistic.
Artistic, yes. At the time, I must tell you, though, it was a big deal. It was unheard of, certainly, and people predicted it would destroy my career, but it did not.
Well, in fact, you've had quite a booming career, and, you know, we really don't often think of women as funeral directors. So what attracted you originally to the profession?
Well, it was not my career choice growing up. I always planned on being a writer. I attended college intending to pursue this writing career, and while in college, I started working in a funeral home. And I have to say, I became very interested by what was going on in the funeral home. Somehow I felt drawn to this career. So after college, I enrolled in mortuary school, intending to get back to the writing at some point. But I was sort of hooked on this career. I felt I brought something to it, a certain empathy and people skills.
Well, do you think that's why women in midlife are really kind of making a decision to sort of go that way?
I absolutely do. I just think there's so much more a woman can do. Not to say there aren't wonderful male funeral directors, because there are, but women can sort of just bond in a more personal way than a man can.
Now, finally, Alexandra, we're almost out of time, but you attend a lot of funerals. What was your favorite all-time funeral of 2013?
Oh, my favorite funeral of 2013 was hands down the funeral of Mayor Ed Koch. That was our mayor in New York for many years. He was a wonderful man, and his funeral was outstanding. And I say that as a person who's attended thousands of funerals over the years.
Right, you should know.
It was such a celebration of his life. And we came away feeling so uplifted after the service.
Huh. And do you just go to these funerals, or do you just...
Well, I write for the trade magazines. I write for two of the biggest trade magazines, American Funeral Director and American Cemetery, for which I profile famous funerals and famous cemeteries.
Okay, because that sure felt funny asking you what your favorite funeral of 2013 was.
Doesn't everyone have a favorite funeral?
I guess.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Alexandra Mosca, funeral director and author of Grave Undertakings, thanks so much
and
for shooting
the piece
with
us.
And now
it's time for
us
to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babe Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media, in collaboration with Zimer Communications.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving.